Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour today, we'll be talking with economist James Galbraith. He holds the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his recent book, The Predator State, the subtitle, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. It's published by Free Press. The free market has long been a key concept for conservatives. Professor Galbraith says even many liberals have come to accept it. But, however, the conservatives now, who are leading the government, have actually abandoned the idea, and he says the result is a state that feeds off the public sector and diverts public money into private hands. As we talk this morning with James Galbraith, the questions are certainly welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that you try to keep your comments and questions brief, just so we can keep moving, getting as many different callers as possible. But certainly, questions, comments, input from listeners, that's all welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois and Indiana, if you're listening on the air, or if you're listening across the country on the internet. Either way, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, comments, you can give us a call. Professor Galbraith, hello. Hello, Professor Galbraith?
Yes, good morning. Oh. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
To begin with, I think in as much as people hear talk about the free market and the importance of the market, I'm not exactly sure that people will know what that means, so maybe that would be a good place to start and give us that. What would be the standard definition if you pick up a basic economics textbook and look that up, look up free market? What would it say?
Well, the underlying idea is that society can be self-organizing, that the presence of government is not required for most matters and should be minimized. This idea got a very concrete expression 28 years ago when Ronald Reagan took office in a combination of policies that were advanced with a very clear vision that they would fix up an economy which was in a lot of trouble at that time. Inflation would be controlled by the Federal Reserve alone, by keeping a tight rein on the money supply. Taxes would be cut, especially at the high end to foster saving and investment work effort. The government would cut back on its regulations. Public services would be privatized. A whole range of measures, which at the time had the authority of a large part of academic economics. I remember going through this material when I was in graduate school. And it had a group of advocates in the public sphere, many of whom I got to know and have gotten to know quite well over the years since, who I think believed in good faith that they were effecting a kind of revolution. This was the Reagan Revolution. And that sets the backdrop for what's happened since.
Just as a kind of a basic question, as you say, I think that for people who talk about the importance of a free market, one of the basic ideas is that the government should not be involved, or at least should be involved only minimally. But it seems that that's a principle that's always been honored in the breach, because I'm not sure that even if you go back over the last 100 years and you look at various administrations, both Democratic and Republican, I'm not sure that anybody, perhaps everyone has a different idea about how the government should be involved, but it seems that in one way or another, the government always is involved.
Oh, that's entirely correct. And even in the Reagan administration, the ideologues had a very short run. But what was interesting about that time was that the government backed off of this in practice. A great part of the tax cuts were repealed and revised over time. The Federal Reserve abandoned monetarism after a very short period of time. The Reagan administration was remarkably interventionist on trade, provoking many of its libertarian supporters to real protest. All of these things were reflected a kind of practical sense, but they never conceded the ideological point. Mm. And what's interesting about the recent period is that in the administration that we've been living under for the last 8 years is that the ideological argument has completely disappeared. One doesn't hear the case that was made for conservative principle from these people. So one has to ask, what exactly is it that they're doing? And that's part of the interpretation that I give to recent history in the predator stage.
So if what you're saying is that if you go back to the Reagan administration, these basic sorts of ideas, supply side economics, monetarism, tax cutting, deregulation, they found out fairly quickly that those things didn't work, or at least it wouldn't get them where they wanted to go, and that they abandoned them. But you're saying now, though, that people still talk, people honor, at least honor by talking about it, Reagan, his economic principles, Reaganomics, they're still talking about them as if those things work, and yet what they're actually doing, and here we're talking about this administration and generally about conservatives, what they're actually doing is something different.
That's true, but we're missing here one important element, which is that the talk had a very powerful effect on the way liberals frame their alternatives. And from the 1980s onward, you got this enormous shift in the liberal vision. It became one essentially of saying the liberal idea is to accept all of the major conservative principles on the priority of fighting inflation, on fiscal responsibility and balancing the budget, on low marginal tax rates, but then to do some things and deregulation as much as possible, but then to do some things that will make the markets work better. And that became essentially the extent of the liberal position. And my argument is that that's simply not adequate for the kinds of problems that we're facing now. And it's very clear that whether you're looking at the financial sector, where the effect of a neglect of an effective regulatory structure has produced a complete collapse of trust and essentially affecting the functioning of the financial system and the ability of that system to fuel the economy, or whether you're looking at a long-range problem like climate change, we are going to be entering into an era where we have to be both more realistic, both about what we do and also about what we say.
Mm. So the argument that some people would make, they would say, well, yes, the market's an imperfect system, and it doesn't really always work, and sometimes we indeed have some problems. But basically, it works good enough so that it can keep us going. You would say, no, that's just not right.
I think we're facing very serious problems that we're going to have to confront in a very serious way over the next generation. I think there is a presumption that many people have that all economic problems are intrinsically temporary. Wait a little while and the economy will recover. Many people are hoping that will happen, that the current crisis of the credit markets will come to an end. But it has been a year. In fact, it's a year today that the credit markets froze up, that banks became unwilling to lend to each other. The Federal Reserve and the other central banks had to come in and start giving unlimited credit, unlimited liquidity to the major banking institutions. And in that year, things have by and large gotten progressively worse. We've become more and more aware of the extent to which the subprime crisis basically poisoned the well of the global financial system. So I'm not optimistic that the system will recuperate without a concerted new set of policies to put our financial system back on a more sound and sustainable foundation.
Mm. So the current crisis.
That's just one example.
The current crisis in the financial markets related to the subprime mortgage problems. You would say that was at heart a failure of regulation or a result of lack of regulation?
Oh, sure, it absolutely was. Most mortgages up to that point in the United States were conforming mortgages that qualified for guarantees from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The subprime a subprime mortgage is by definition a mortgage that doesn't conform. These were originated by companies that came up out of nowhere, companies like Countrywide, that were not subject to regulation. And then they were, as a result of the deregulation of the banking system, they were packaged in all kinds of arcane, esoteric ways, sold to investors around the world in various combinations. And a system was created where there was no real understanding of what those assets were worth, and so it worked so long as people basically took it on faith that they were worth something. But when the housing sector began to decline, people lost confidence, and a major part of the financial system was taken down by it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is economist James Galbraith. He teaches at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin and is the author of a recent published book that's titled The Predator State. The subtitle is How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. It's published by the Free Press. And we have several callers here lined up and ready to go, so we'll bring them in, starting with someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
This is me?
Yes.
Okay. Do you have anything to add to Professor Stephen Cohen's criticism of shock therapy when the Soviet Union went from state socialism to whatever form of capitalism it has today? And how can the rest of the world protect itself against the weird politics of the United States when it applies to our financial people?
Well, first of all, I'm a great admirer of Steve Cohen's, and I think he's was one of our most important observers of what happened in Russia in this period of transition from the Soviet Union through 1998, the big crisis there. And what did happen there was, of course, an enormous tragedy, one which had very serious consequences for the population of Russia. Life expectancy amongst Russian men fell from something in the low 70s to something in the high 50s as a result of stress and violence, unemployment. So you were looking at a disaster that should have been avoided if it could have been avoided. I think is probably the best way you can put it. Whether it could have been avoided given the state of the Soviet Union in its last years is a very much an open and debatable question, but it's of course very interesting that the Chinese did manage to avoid and have managed to avoid anything similar, and the change in the relative position of the Soviet Union and China economically in the last 30 years has been absolutely astonishing, and reflects, I think, the relatively reasonable gradual approach that the Chinese took to economic reform.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Urbana for another caller. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. I'm Sean Mine from Urbana. Yes, I had a question. As I understand it, the way in which the deregulation is justified is through the equilibrium theory. That you look at an equilibrium of an economic model, it's efficient, and you say everything works. And I'm actually a professor in the air of controls at the University of Illinois, and that would be our starting point. If I was going to look at an airplane and try to come up with a control system for it, I'd say, yes, it's a nice equilibrium, and then I would want to stabilize it. And I'd put in some controls, which in economic terms would be market mechanisms, to keep so that if there's uncertainty or noise here is a disturbance like wind, the system would bring you back to this nice equilibrium. And I just wonder if economists appreciate that they do they realize that there's a dynamical system and there's uncertainty and a static equilibrium analysis is obviously not enough.
Well, I think it's clear, if I understand your analogy, that the controls in the cockpit of the aircraft are analogous to the regulatory system.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. That's correct. And there is a whole body of economic theory that deals with the problems of unregulated markets, in particular the idea that there are externalities. Other people are affected who are not party to the transaction. But the reality is that almost all important transactions are just riddled with externalities. So there is no productive system in an advanced economy, whether you're looking at the food chain or products of technology or just about anything, infrastructure, communications, transportation networks, that doesn't involve large elements over which the consumer really has no direct control, no direct say, over which, and where you're basically relying on checks and balances in the productive system, including regulation, to make sure that the things work, to make sure that the salad doesn't have salmonella in it, to make sure that your television doesn't explode. These things are part of a regulatory process. When you turn the regulation over to the most regressive elements of the producing community, of the business community, what you run the risk of is that people are going to lose confidence in the system. And when they lose confidence in the system, it breaks down. And that's really the difference, I would argue, between a developed country and a less developed country, is that the latter don't have regulatory systems that people can trust and do trust.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Yes, it does. I just wonder if this is appreciated by mainstream economists now. It seems so so apparent, and I wonder if that's understood now.
Well, I think in academic economics it's very well understood, but when you get down into the political discussion, all of these finer points are totally lost.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And we'll go on to another caller. This is Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. Could I ask you two questions? One is about the subprime crisis, and the other is about financial institutions that are too big to fail. About the subprime crisis, these subprime loans, long before the subprime situation became a crisis, it was seen as a very perilous situation. I heard some of the smart money talking about the housing bubble that was about to burst, and it seems to me, weren't there regulations that were in place? If those regulations, those loan regulations, mortgage regulations, had been enforced at the correct time to prevent improvident loans from being made, couldn't that have avoided the recession that we have now? In other words, we didn't need any new laws. Simply enforce the laws that were there. And I have another question for you.
I think the answer to your question is yes. The regulatory authorities had plenty of power to step in on this process. But in fact, Alan Greenspan, as many recall, was actively encouraging people to take advantage of these short-term adjustable rate mortgages with short-term teaser rates.
Yep.
And that, of course, was basically poisoning the well, in my view.
Yeah, because when he lowered interest rates so low, that made it easy for people to get loans, and they knew those rates were going to go up, so those rates had to adjust up.
The lenders certainly knew. I think many of the borrowers were very relatively unsophisticated, and we shouldn't presume that they knew what was going to happen to them 2 or 3 years down the road. But in a situation like that, where you have where you're clearly putting the borrower in a position which you, the lender, know they won't be able to sustain, that's an abusive practice, and there's plenty of regulatory authority to step in and do that, including taking to the airwaves and warning people that they're being beset by sharp practices and they should be wary. But, of course, none of that was done. And I think there was a reason, which was at the highest levels, the administration of the Federal Reserve realized that this was a way to keep the economy growing in 2005 and 2006. Sustain the growth of the housing sector. And Greenspan explicitly believed that basically the way the economy functioned was to go from bubble to bubble and clean up the messes afterwards. The problem is that at some level, and when talking about housing, you're at the highest possible level, the bubble gets so large and the mess so great that it becomes very difficult to clean up. It takes a long time.
Yeah, and that brings me to my second question about institutions that are too big to fail. It seems to me somehow institutions should not be allowed to get too big to fail, because then when they get into a jam, they know the government has to bail them out. Just comment on that, please.
Well, a friend of mine who works on these problems in England said his solution would be to save the institution and tell the bankers that they should reapply for their licenses, so that individual responsibility would still be present. And I don't know exactly how you apply that to in the American banking context, but the idea is a very good one, that there may well be institutions that you want to, where you don't want a precipitous collapse, because then a lot of innocent counterparties get hurt, but where you do want to make sure that the management finds other more suitable employment, because they obviously should not be in the business of having a what is in some ways a quasi-public trust, which is certainly the case for lots of large institutions in the financial sector.
Well, certainly Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they were, how should we say, they were quasi-government institutions, and they're too big to fail, and they're bankrupt, and the government just got to bail them out.
I don't think that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are actually bankrupt. They hold actually the better assets in the housing sector. They're obviously affected by the general decline and collapse of the housing sector, but the idea behind those two institutions was and remains a very good idea, which they did something that the private sector would not have done by itself, and they got an enormous number of American households into homes that they actually own. I think a foundation stone of prosperity in this country. So that's a little bit of a yes, there was bad management there, and yes, there were overpaid executives. But there's a case where you really have a public policy interest in making sure that the system stays on stays reasonably stable.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So I would assume that then you would have supported both the government's moving in to prevent the collapse of Bear Stearns, and also the government saying that it essentially would guarantee Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
On Bear Stearns, of course, Bear Stearns did collapse. It has disappeared. What the government protected was the people who did business with Bear Stearns. And I think they were right to do that, yes.
Hmm. When people talk about the free market as, and I suppose this may in a sense be a kind of a straw man, but they say, well, okay, the alternative then is a centrally planned economy, which turns off a lot of people. Is that the alternative, or is there something that's in the middle?
No, of course not. I mean, the phrase central planning is just thrown into the discussion to evoke the Soviet Union and bring it into the conversation. I think any well-organized economy has got to have an element of planning, which is to say some agency with some authority that has the responsibility to think ahead and to envision, to imagine what the major problems are going to be and how they can best be solved. That's, I think, a reason why we have a democratically elected government, is to do that. And if one simply refuses the concept of planning, you're basically turning over the planning function to large corporations who do, of course, plan, but who have very limited and narrow spheres of interest and objectives, and they're not operating in the larger national interest at all. So my argument here is that the government needs to be able to think, and that is not the same thing as putting everything under a quota and rationing system by any means.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is James Galbraith. He holds the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His most recent book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. That's the subtitle. Free Press is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Next caller up is in Effingham. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, my view is rather wide of the subject matter today. A couple of things. Can your guest confirm that capitalism now is either at or over 700 years old, as we know it?
I don't know what you're giving it as its birth date.
About 1175.
And the specific event?
It evolved out of mercantilism.
That's an interesting question.
Well,
I would As any economist, I think, place Adam Smith in 1776 as
The modern turn, but it
as the founding definer of what capitalism is, and that book, of course, is a major attack on mercantilism. But we could, give or take 500 years, what's that between friends?
Well, and that being the case, and now in these latter days, the paradigm has become imperialized, where the power that capitalism is now is accrued into fewer and fewer hands. And then we have, and I'll take you back to Scotland again, and John Law, and how he proceeded to hoodwink people and relieve that emerging middle class and some bankers of their money. Well, that thing, that and today's crisis and the housing, I mean, these things are not new. And somehow a whole new generation of suckers are born and then hoodwinked again. You know, and when my guess, what I'm saying now is that the system is so corrupt that how are we going to fix it?
Well, I think you put your finger on a very important point, which is that capitalism has always been, to a degree, unstable and fragile. And of course, a capitalist system that was substantially dominated by a small group of very rich people existed and collapsed in the late 1920s in this country. And that gave rise to the modern American economy, which has a very large public component. Social Security, government's role in higher education, in healthcare, in housing, the government's role in research and development ever since the Second World War, in providing for the security of the country as a whole. All of these things create a public presence which is generally for most of this time quite stabilizing. It tended to reduce the incidence of deep recessions, mass unemployment, without being so overbearing as to stifle industrial and technical innovation or the development of the consumer sector, everything else that basically made the United States rich in this period. That's the problem here, is that by denying the centrality of the public role, we basically allow a politics to develop which consists of feeding off of it without that becoming the center of our attention. And everybody then talks about, you know, the free market versus the government as though that was the right way to frame the decision in our economic politics. And I don't think it is.
Can I say one more thing, David?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, please. The stats of today, and you talked about the collapse of 1929, but there's a whole history of ups and downs of the capitalist paradigm. 1929 was the worst, and then came... Hoover was going to just let it play out. But if that had happened, then you would have had revolution. I mean, it would have not been pretty either. So Roosevelt stifled all that with public works and then, of course, World War II. Now, after World War II and all the wars, including those up to date, now have proven to be distractions from the reality that one-third of the people in this supposed most richest nation in the world, one-third of the population live in poverty. And the manufacturing base is gone. It took 25 years or so to move everything overseas. 85% of people in the U.S. who are working work in a state of service, and 15% in manufacturing. 20 to 25 years ago, that was the opposite. Now, all that, and what are people to do? And the population continues to grow. People are dying unnecessarily because they can't get any health insurance. And the industry of health care now is, again, have you got the money to pay your bill? And if you are not, if I can relate this one thing, that I sat with my granddaughter for 8 hours from a bee sting on her lip, which swelled to three times its size, people with health care insurance walked through, and my granddaughter sat with her lip. And she sat there, and it finally went down. If she had been allergic, would she be dead? What kind of world are we living in? And the production of the nonsense that capitalism is and should be eradicated, what has to happen before? You know, Roosevelt, like I said, avoided revolution. But if the next Obama or McCain, who have no ideas and are going to just let the thing continue to downgrade to where then half the population is in poverty, and then we have two-thirds, I mean, then you have people fighting people, just like the National Guard of the 30s, and what they do today in this country and around the world. How do we address those problems? And how, I mean, I'm not making this stuff up. I'm an old man, and I have lived through this stuff. And how is it then that we can continue on this path and somehow make sense of life? And thank you, and I'll hang up, David. Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Galbraith, you can comment on that any way you can.
Well, I'll just say that I think the achievement of universal health care is very, very high, huge priority, and will come up again very soon as one of the top political issues that we'll face in the administration ahead. But it's also, I think, the case that strengthening other parts of our social safety net is going to again become very important in the environment that we'll be in. I'm not optimistic that next year we'll see a robust economic recovery with suddenly a lot of people finding good jobs in the private sector as we did in the 1990s. I think that this year the economy has been propped up by tax cuts, by increases in military spending, by low interest rates, by a low dollar, which has supported our exports. And that's the reason why we have avoided so far a formal recession. Next year, it's not clear that those props will be there. And I think that it's going to be very interesting to see what the next president does. And I think that measures which get as many people as possible back to work, rebuilding the public infrastructure, creating green jobs that can help put our energy and environmental situation onto a more sustainable track, but also strengthening Social Security, taking steps to help build up the basic pension, standard of living for elderly people, many of whom are losing their investments because of the general decline in capital markets. These are all going to be, I think, to some degree on the agenda.
I have some other calls here. I wanted to get onto them, but just there's a point that I want to have you address, and that has to do with privatization. One of the things that now Republican administrations have really been committed to is, at least what they say, is the idea of smaller government. I'm not exactly sure that it is, but the idea of smaller government and, as a result, taking functions that were performed by government and spinning them off to private interests and all sorts of things that government had done before, including military functions. I know that you feel that's a problem. Why is that a problem?
Because there are some things which should be kept in the public sphere because they can be done more efficiently or better supervised in that sphere. And I think many security professionals agree that there has been too much privatization of military functions to contractors. And obviously, it's been the Blackwater situation is a major problem in Iraq. If we're talking about the privatization of a major retirement program like Social Security, what we would find is that the administrative costs would be much higher under a private system, and the predictability of benefits would be substantially lower because it would depend upon how your investments did in a very volatile capital market. That area, the general area of insurance, is something which is best done on a very broad-based and universal basis because it can be done very efficiently in large economies of scale. That's not to say that there aren't some functions which the private sector should be doing. I mean, we would not want the private sector building houses. I mean, the public sector building houses. It's at least, you know, the kinds of houses that we have been building, perfectly adequately built by private contractors. We would not want there are certainly certain public functions which sometimes start out in the public sphere, aviation, for example, in many countries, which can move to the private sphere perfectly adequately and perfectly successfully. But to make a blanket declaration that you should be, that the public functions should be privatized as a matter of principle, is surely a policy mistake.
All right, let's go and talk with some other folks who are here listening. Next, Charleston, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, I was. I noticed that I've been to another state than in Charleston, Illinois, for example, which has lost probably about 3,000-4,000 jobs since the turn of the century or the millennium. I mean, literally that many jobs. And they continue to build these great big houses. They just keep building all these homes, and the tax bills start at least $6,000 a year. Now, I went out to Oklahoma, and I've been out there pretty recently and several times, but of course the last couple of years, and the houses are not, super huge, but there is a heck of a lot of manufacturing jobs out there. There's so many jobs that they were competing among themselves, and they had to up the wages, to $3-4 an hour just to get people to come to work out there.
Okay, is there? And can you give us a question? Something that we can.
Well, I was wondering, how do you think the economy? It seems like the economy is worse in one area than in another, and I wonder, how next year will play out, or the future years will play out with such economies. You expect the housing market might get solved a little bit, or regulated, or cleaned up a little bit, where there'll be some stability in the economy. And here in these towns in Illinois, they keep building these big homes that people, in the very least, are going to have to travel over 100 miles each way to work to pay for those homes and make the payments, because there aren't the jobs like here in Illinois to pay for those expensive houses, especially when you get the tax bill on them every year on top of the mortgage.
Yeah. Well, Jay, Professor Galmuth, you were talking a little bit earlier about the fact that it's difficult to predict what is likely to happen. We don't know who the next president is going to be. We really don't know what the economy is going to be doing next year.
I think that the housing – let me say a word or two more on the housing
issue.
We went through this in Texas 20 years ago. The problem with a housing slump is that the houses stay with you. They remain in inventory. Many of them remain vacant. They deteriorate. And so you have a problem which deepens over time. In some ways, losing a factory is easier because it closes and something else can be opened up in its place. But it's hard to build new houses when houses that were built 2 or 3 years ago are sitting there as a drug on the market. And that suggests that this problem is going to be around for quite a long time. The crucial step, I think, immediately is to do as much as possible to keep people in their homes so that the houses that we have built get used and don't deteriorate as much as they otherwise would, dragging down the value of everything in the neighborhood. That's going to be something I think policy's got to address very, very quickly. The recent housing bill took a step in that direction, but I'm almost certain more will be required.
I want to thank the caller, and we just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. I also want to introduce again our guest. We're talking with James Galbraith. He's an economist. He holds the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, and is the author of the recent book, The Predator State, the subtitle, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. It's published by Free Press. I have another caller here, and we'll get right to them. This is Matt Toon in line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I'm just curious about the extension of credit that occurred in the 20s and the extension of credit that has occurred currently. The usury laws and loan sharking back in the 60s, there was laws that on the books that any more than interest rates of 20% was considered illegal. And today, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, car loan I think, and very highly cost interest and sometimes risky loans. But and I don't see how when the prime rate goes down to like 2%, the credit card companies, you know, are often, especially even college students, that are in the 20s for their interest rates. I don't know, you know, how these things can be justified, how regulations are not changing some of this to protect the consumer a little bit. I'd like to hear your comments.
No, I think it's a high priority. You mentioned the 1920s. One of the things that banks were able to do in the 1920s is they were able to take deposits and also engage in underwriting securities. So they were in the business of basically speculating in the stock market. That contributed to the collapse of 1929 to 1933. And in 1933, in the Glass-Steagall Law, Congress basically said we've got to separate these two functions. We've got to have banks, which are insured, stable, reliable institutions, and investment banks, which can engage in much more speculative activities, but if they fail, they fail. Well, in 1999, and I have to say that was under a Democratic administration, the Glass-Steagall Law was repealed, and banks got right back into the business of promoting these securities. That is a large part of what happened in the housing crisis, because all these bad loans were packaged together in lots of 10,000 or so, these dodgy mortgages, and sold to investors in very complicated ways. Of course, when the value of those instruments collapsed, the banks found that they still had a lot of them in their own portfolios, and that affected the net worth of the banks. So we recreated a situation very similar to the 1920s with very similar consequences in an amazingly short period of time. And, yes, we clearly need to have systems which protect the consumer, but we also need new systems which create more stable behavior in the financial system so that we have institutions that are making loans on a sustained basis, supporting business activity, small business job creation, and the rest, rather than financial institutions which are so crippled by the recklessness of their own past behavior that they really can't do anything for a long period of time. And that's what I greatly fear at the moment.
Well, what I think, though, is that you're looking at it from a top-down approach, which I think is, you know, you're very accurate in your approach. But I think if you look at it from the person who's struggling on the bottom 25%, that there's just inhumane practices of credit that are being used on these people.
Oh, there's a lot of predatory credit. I totally agree with that. And the part of the solution here is certainly to crack down on it. And part of it is, you know, a much more concerted strategy to narrow the income gap and the wage gap in this country to assure that people who are in the lower part of the wage structure, lower part of the wage spectrum, nevertheless have a living wage. Raising the minimum wage, extremely important step. Making sure that people who work full-time are above the poverty line, can support their families. And then you reduce the pressure on people to extend their resources by taking credit on terms which is abusive or can't be sustained. I think you're putting your finger on a very complicated problem, but it is certainly one of the most important expressions of predatory behavior that we see in the country today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask you about something else, and I know that it's something at one point you address in the book. I suppose some people would say that one of the big problems we have today is unrestrained spending by consumers of money that they don't really have, and that one of our big problems, and I think some people have argued this for some time, one of the big problems we have is that people don't save enough and that government ought to be doing more to encourage people to save. Is the savings rate of Americans problematically low, and if so, is there something government could do about it?
I think there's very little benefit in wasting too much time talking about the low savings rate. People have been trying to raise the savings rate for decades without any success. It isn't really the essential issue. And what we need to have is a spirit of investment and job creation, which creates employment and generates income. And at that point, people's incomes improve. They'll save a little more, so the circle closes. But if people try to save more, try to be more thrifty, first of all, you're asking them to do something which isn't very realistic because most people's resources are not, and they don't have a lot of things that they are consuming that they can really forego. So it's a bit like baying at the moon. But it also, if you did succeed, the effect of not spending income that you have is to cost other people their jobs. So we all have to be conscious that we need to make the economy work. And the way to do that is to envision what we should be doing and to begin to get it done. And clearly, to me, we have an enormous task in the area of energy and environment. I think we could keep the whole country basically employed for a generation if we took that task seriously, and we could persuade the rest of the world that we are the country with the technical capability to act on these matters, and it's worth their while to keep help us keep our system going until we have solved these problems. That's the way I would go forward, a way which is, I think, consistent with a very high level of employment and really pretty decent improving living standards. And if you were putting our technical resources into rebuilding this country rather than into the places where we know it's gone in the last 8 years, notably places like Iraq, living standards would get better here.
Well, aside from having the government be perhaps more directly involved in spending money in things like building up infrastructure or in promoting the development of green energy, for example, those sorts of things, do you think that the government should be directly involved in the economy to the point of, say, wage and price controls?
Well, the government is part of the economy. So I think the opposition of the economy and the government is really very artificial. The government is deeply embedded in almost every major economic sector that we have. Certain prices, the interest rate, for example, is set by government. So are the wage standards of the wage rates of government employees who must comprise nearly a third of the workforce. So we are looking at a system which already has a strong element of government influence in price setting. That's just the reality. Should we be controlling all prices? No, of course not. We don't need to. And so that's not my argument. But I do think that it's appropriate for the government to set standards for the private sector. The minimum wage is such a standard. It should be considerably higher than it is. Living wages, which go beyond the minimum wage to say that if you are taking public money, your employees should be decently compensated, is a kind of standard that I think is entirely appropriate. And so I think if you do that, you have actually two effects. You greatly reduce poverty, but you also improve the efficiency of private business, because in any given business, there are more advanced and less advanced participants. And what you want to do is to put a kind of gentle pressure on the less advanced businesses to say, look, if you can't meet the standards, you should be in some other line of work, or you should give way to some other entrepreneur who can meet them. And if by doing that, you upgrade the productivity of the country as a whole and overall living standards improve.
Just quickly, I'm curious about what you think about the economic, what was called the economic stimulus plan that was passed by the Congress that essentially basically amounted to sending money out to people, whether that was productive at all, misguided. Did it do anything? Did it do nothing?
Well, it did something. I think it did keep us out of a much more severe recession this year. I nevertheless opposed it because I thought it was a stopgap, and I thought it created the illusion that, or was based on the premise that the economy would recover by itself once the stimulus was in place. And we're clear that didn't happen. What we're already seeing is a need for a second package. What we need to recognize is that we've come in this past year to a situation which has some long-term characteristics, and what we need to be developing is a 3 to 5 year program to get us out of it. If we keep thinking we can do something on a 6-month or 1 year basis, we're going to find that we're, first of all, we won't succeed, and people will start losing confidence in the mechanism, and I think that would be very dangerous.
And have either of the two candidates, Senators McCain or Obama, in talking about what they would do as far as the economy is concerned, either of them proposing things that you would support?
Well, I hesitate to implicate either of them in my views, but of course I'm enthusiastic about Senator Obama, and I think that part of his program, particularly where he has been speaking of public infrastructure investment and the green jobs initiatives, these are exactly on the right track. And he also said something the other day about how if we could inspire confidence in our economy and get it moving again, this will be good for the value of the dollar, which struck me as being basically sensible and having the right economic instinct. It is, people will invest in the United States, people from around the world will invest in the United States and support us when they feel we're doing something that's worth doing.
Well, there we will leave it with thanks to our guest, James Galbraith. He holds the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. You want to read more of his thinking on these subjects, look for his book, The Predator State. It's published by Free Press. Professor Galbraith, thank you very much.
Thank you.